Media shouldn't be one note. Support Rabble.ca and a diversity of voices in Canadian media. Visit rabble.ca/donate to contribute.
You're listening to The Green Majority here on CIUT 89.5 FM. I'm your host, Darren Kaster. I'm also in studio again with Stefan.
How you doing?
Who I'm actually going to, because I have to organize the rest of our show, I'm going to throw to Stefan to introduce our special guest this week.
Oh, amazing. Fantastic. I'm here with Barbara Grachalova, which I'm pretty sure... Grachalova.
Almost.
All right. I'm pretty sure Darren just threw to me just so I would, so he didn't have to try to say your last name. I'm pretty sure that's actually what happened.
The hot potato, yeah.
Yeah, exactly. Barbara's been on the show before and will be joining us again. We'll largely taking the middle section of the show to talk about, if correct me if I'm wrong, but talk about the cap and trade system specifically in California. But because Ontario has actually joined that, it has Canadian implications as well.
Yes, that was a very good summary.
Amazing.
Yeah, just a bit of an update, yeah.
An update, fantastic. I feel like to carry on the update theme then, I also, our top news story of the day, once again, for the second week in a row, I get to say our top news story is North Dakota, which I didn't think I'd ever get to say, but now I'm going to say 2 weeks in a row that our top news story is North Dakota, which is because I would say minutes after our last show. Just mere minutes. If you had just done it earlier, we could have had another. We always like breaking news on the show because we're once a week, so it's really we don't actually get to break news that often.
I stay here at CIUT to finish producing the show for the rest of the day. I almost hijacked back onto someone else's show and was like, "Never mind that music."
Yeah,
Green Majority 4 in the afternoon, breaking news.
Yes, exactly. Because right after our show, very shortly after our show, there was a setback and then a victory in very quick succession. The setback was that this is again about the Dakota Access Pipeline and the ongoing battle, which now includes upwards of 200 different Native American tribes who are now helping block this pipeline in North Dakota. And they've all come across, I think it's now North America. I don't think anyone has flown in from outside of North America, but I also could be wrong. But anyways, so this is about that. So,
well, if I can stop you there, Stefan, yeah. It's really good that they didn't fly in because, as we know from many of the corporate types that we've spoken to personally before, mm-hmm. that is, if you ever take an airplane, you therefore have no right to make any argument for climate change again.
Exactly. Yeah. Well, or even more local and recent. The protests that happened here against the DAPL pipeline were criticized because they blocked transit and made people have to idle in their cars. So you can't protest if you're blocking any type of vehicle that may be emitting any emissions.
Well, I guess we're at a stalemate because then, in my opinion, anytime any person who works for an oil company opens their mouth, they're exhaling toxic fumes.
Mm.
So I guess we're deadlocked.
Yeah, we're all lost.
I mean, Toronto has a no idling bylaw, so all those people could have actually been fined under that potentially.
Well, there we go. Do you find the protesters? The other people, let's be real here, Toronto would probably find a way to find the protesters. But to the actual news, we will promise we will eventually get this, is that shortly after our show, the request that these tribes, one particular, I believe it's a Sioux Nation, but I could be wrong, I'm sorry, I don't have it in front of me, was denied, by the federal government, not the judge, basically. But it's shortly thereafter, that news was trumped, if I can use that word, if that's not a slur. I feel like it's already a slur. So if I'm allowed to say that word on community radio, it was trumped.
In a couple of months, that language might be banned from our lexicon. But.
Yes, but right now we're fine. Great. Because in a major concession, the Obama administration actually announced that it would not grant a permit for a key portion of the project near Siouxland, until further an extensive review. So that was both shocking. I don't think anyone expected that. At least it was not in any of the conversations as a possibility when this is all going through. I read a couple articles of different people being like, where's Obama on this? And then he shows up and they're like, oh, wow. Oh, that's where Obama is on this. Also, I want to point out that our show was mildly prophetic in that I think you ended the show by saying Obama was going to pay attention to climate change after his presidency ended. And then later on, he's like, he heard you. You were goading him. And he's like, fine, Darren, here. I will block this pipeline.
To be fair and more importantly, accurate, I was reporting a news story that I was reading.
Oh, yeah, so, for sure. Yes.
But I think what's really important here, I mean, just to talk about that for a really quick second, because I think that angle on it is really important because, like, as we've said before, Obama's attitude is that he has a very cynical – I would say he's actually more cynical than we are. And that bar is high.
Yeah, it is very high.
But, you know, his whole thing is that he's picked a few battles he wanted to fight. One of them was healthcare. And you know, his attitude was that, you know, I can only push so much so fast, and he might've been right, but I just wish he would have tried. And so this whole thing about, you know, what I'm going to fight climate change, you know, after, and you know, you could say that to certain things and, you know, stopping Keystone, whatever, but this was all due to massive amounts of public pressure. And I think that he doesn't have a lot of fight in him. And I think that I actually do believe that he will probably be a reasonably strong, if not incredibly strong advocate after he leaves office. I simply disagree with him that he had the ability to do more while he was in office. I have more faith in his abilities than apparently he does. But there's a lot of issues where he simply has picked his battles and on to a wider degree, I would say on climate change, he's decided not to fight. He's decided to hold the line in a lot of cases, but I don't think he's fought nearly as hard as he could have, and he's not used all the tools at his disposal to go after it. And so that's why, you know, the end of the show, I sort of said, you know, read between the lines. Well, now that I have a moment, those are the lines I'm trying to draw. Was that, yeah, okay, you could say he certainly hasn't been the biggest, you know, anti-climate change president ever, but not doing stuff is also a choice. And I think he's made a choice to not take action until after office when he conveniently has very little power. So whether or not we believe him, he'll fight hard after he leaves office. The opportunity has still been lost.
If I can at least in partial defense of Obama and in partial – not necessarily correction, but they did actually – Obama did actually attempt to get a cap and trade bill through legislation.
He's attempted to do a lot of things, and we won't dig into the show, but I think he could have tried a lot harder. As I said, that's sort of where I was getting at, but there's a lot of tools at his disposal he's not used that he could have. Mm. And so that's where I both acknowledge that and maintain my point.
All right. Fair enough. So the point actually – reason why I wanted to start North Dakota was A, to provide this update because we've been sort of following it along. I will once again reiterate that if you really want to follow this issue, go to Democracy Now! Or time travel an hour beforehand of this show and listen to it. Because they've been super extensive coverage, so much so apparently too extensive coverage, because the host of Democracy Now! Now has a warrant out for her arrest. Amy Goodman was in North Dakota covering this and apparently covering something that you've deemed an illegal protest is now also acting as an illegal part of the legal protest. So she had to actually, I think she was traveling and had to go back to the States to basically be like, really, guys, really? But what I wanted to really address actually was all of this conversation about whether or not so writing this whenever a pipeline gets delayed or something like that, there's a rallying cry of like, look, we're being heard, we're winning, this is great. But I saw a couple articles out there that were basically saying the opposite on this one. They were saying like this is a bad thing, or why this isn't necessarily good. And I, to paraphrase, I believe the argument was that basically that the delay would hurt the ability to protest because, you know, now that there was a delay, people might it would drop off the radar. It was actually, this issue was getting some salience, was actually getting into national discourse in some ways, you know, not fantastically, you know, Trump still trumps. But there is still a level of the conversation. And by moving on from this, or by Obama making this decision, it would allow people to sort of forget about it again. And maybe the all the momentum that was built to actually finish the end the pipeline would lost. And then later on, another White House would just say, okay, never mind, take the permits. And then it would still get built. And I understand that argument, but at the same time, if we can't celebrate our victories, we will never celebrate anything. And if you can't get mad at a government for saying – for not listening to you, and then when it takes action to listen to you, say, well, that's going to hurt us for rallying around not – us not listening to us. And so it's like – I get the point they were trying to make, but also at the same time, I don't – I feel like it's whenever people criticize the left for not being able to win with them, or whenever people criticize the left for, like, you know, we give you an inch and then you're mad at us, you didn't give us a mile. This is the kind of stuff that they're pointing out. If a right wing issue got some success at some point, none of them would be like, well, this isn't good enough. Or at least that wouldn't have the same. I feel like they don't have that same sort of reactionary distrust. Which makes it hard to pander to us, which makes our issues harder to get. Like, as silly as that sounds, it makes it harder to pander to environmentalists if environmentalists refuse to accept the victories they're trying to give us.
So another insight on this, and one of the things I was thinking about with this particular story is that, you know, I was wondering, because things will come across our desk, and the Dakota Access Pipeline, frankly, is one of them. And now we should, you know, this would take our weekly reminder to our listeners that we are, of course, you know, volunteers, and we have actual jobs outside of this, and therefore are not able to pay, you know, 24 hours a day attention to this, despite my brief attempt at doing so. So sometimes, you know, things I'll go to do my news cycle routine, and I'll be like, there's something will come up about, oh, there's a protest about this pipeline that's like about to be finished. And be like, why? How did I not know about it? Like, how did I get this far? And there's part of an answer to that was discovered. There was a really interesting article posted on Common Dreams, actually, about the Dakota Access Pipeline. And one of the things that it brings up at the end there is something called the FERC, which I'm going to have to refer to my notes here, Federal Energy Regulatory Commission, which was... put together in 1938 to grant private corporations the power of eminent domain over local jurisdictions. Oh, eminent domain, of course, being a fancy way of saying, you think that's yours? Yeah, no, it's mine now. It gives the government the power to basically override, you know, supposedly owned land and all sorts of other rights, and basically just be like, it's a backdoor to be able to just wipe out people's rights when it comes to property. And the idea was, of course, this was during the rebuilding, the building of the recovering and tied into the war effort. And then, of course, the recovery after the war effort and all those sorts of things. There was a number of policies of which the creation of FERC was made. The problem is that it still exists with the same insane powers. And it's, largely considered by many to be a rogue agency in many degrees. Because they, in many respects, don't need to go through other levels of government. They can simply be appealed and grant these permissions. And so one of the reasons why so often these pipelines get to such a late stage is, you know, despite the fact that we have numerous reports of mayors and townships and entire communities protesting and saying, no, we don't want this going through our community. This is not safe. You know, never mind the First Nations groups whose, you know, land is being taken away and poisoned and everything else, is because essentially the corporations can go straight to this agency, which has immense power. And not nearly enough oversight, many would argue, and I would join them, to essentially just plow the way for them despite any opposition. And so it gets to this, it's nearly completed process, this part of the process, simply because there is very little red tape, and these agencies with an incredible amount of power and very little oversight essentially just like bully everybody out of the way, and there's very little you can do, and because of that it can happen so quickly that the thing's halfway built before anybody even catches wind of it. In many cases, of course, not, you know, the industry, they know exactly what's going on. The government in many cases knows exactly what's going on, but the public doesn't have a ton of time to rally against it because it's halfway built before most of them have even figured out what's going on. I mean, the land can be taken and start to be under construction before the people in the neighborhood even know what it's being built in some cases. So I just thought that was an interesting interesting angle to bring into this.
Oh yeah, and they've done it in a specific way. They're building it in small pieces as well to avoid other. You know, it's one of those things where it's like, well, if you build a really really long pipeline, then you have to get this entire assessment. If you build a bunch of small pipelines that just happen to be connected, then you don't have to get like it's a silly way to get around this environmental assessments. Last piece of the news story of North Dakota news before I guess we'll go right to the music break is that North Dakota oil pipelines, the people who are actually building this pipeline are saying it could hit producers and shippers. So they're warning everyone this pipeline delay is gonna mean that everyone's gonna pay more money, which is funny because to tie this back into sort of this kind of messaging. It also exists right now with the cap and trade bill that's happening in Ontario. I'll try to create the segue so we can go segue into the next section, which is that this sort of thinking where like whenever you know the big corporate business something like doesn't get their way or doesn't get their $3.8 billion pipeline, they're very very quick to inform everyone. But this is going to affect you. Climate change isn't going to affect you, but this is going to cost you an extra dollar when you want to get gas, and that's what should matters. And the exact same thing is currently happening to cap and trade in Ontario, and so much so that Enbridge is currently actually sending out in their bills. It says in their bill telling you about it's an extra like, oh, this amount of money for the cap and trade bill, and then in it not only does it say like. It's forming everyone like your bill is going to go up because of the cap and trade. It also then just says, and we're just going to pass it on to the consumer. They're like, there's no hiding that part. They're like, it's going to go, the price is going to go up, and we are making no effort to make it not cost you more money. It's going to cost you directly more money, so you should not like this. And it's just so it's the same sort of thinking of which, you know, heaven forbid that either any of these organizations think about the other ways costs are happening or the other things that could be happening or even can try to step in to maybe actually, you know, pay for some of this or find a way to decrease. Enbridge, if your energy source was cheaper or was cleaner, you wouldn't have to pass so much of the cost on to the consumer. But no, they're not going to change how they do things. All they want to do is make sure that you know why you're paying more.
You're paying because of cap and trade, not because it's an it's a carbon intensive energy source.
Yet. Exactly. Yeah. Exactly. So with that, we can go to music break, and then we'll come right back to actually hear what's up with this cap and trade, which is exactly how I'm going to phrase the first question to you, Barbara. So
what's up with cap and trade?
That's exactly what you're going to.
That sounds like a paper I wrote. So Barbara will be joining us in just a minute to talk about cap and trade. I also wanted to tease, now that I had a second to get my head in the game here, to tease the end of the program where we're going to be talking a little bit about the Monsanto Bayer merger and the quote five alarm threat to our food supply a little bit, and a very fascinating article about a sugar study. Or rather, how sugar pulled the wool over your eyes and made you be really concerned about fat. Those are some interesting stories from the end of the show. But before that, we're going to go, as Stefan just mentioned, to, in this case, Serena Ryder, Got Your Number. Stefan, I'm so sorry to interrupt your dancing.
Oh, man. Well, I just put the headphones back on and then you hit the chorus. How could I not?
All right. So will you please lead us into the next section?
For sure. So as teased right before that wonderful music break, we are in the studio with Barbara Grakolova. Grakolova. Nailed it this time. Maybe. Maybe not. We'll find out.
That was good.
All right. I'll take it. Who's an environmental lawyer here in the city of Toronto. And she's going to take us through the cap and trade bill, both in California, and then what's going to happen here in Ontario, or how that impacts Ontario and I guess Quebec theoretically, because they're also the same. We're all on the same team. I don't know what we call this, but we'll find out. Because Barbara, what's up with cap and trade?
What's up with cap and trade? So the team is called Western Climate Initiative.
Right. So we have a team name. This is fantastic.
We have a team name. Yeah, we have a team name. Okay.
Do we get jerseys?
I hope so. So I've just been sort of trying to follow what the news are around cap and trade and getting my head around this. So essentially, it's no longer a bill in Ontario. Ontario has passed the law.
Okay.
Ontario will be getting cap and trade. So starting next January, there will be carbon pricing in Ontario. Yay, talk about celebrating successes,
yeah,
right?
Exactly.
This is an amazing thing. So the thing is that Ontario is a member of the Western Climate Initiative, which is a group of, I don't remember how many, I believe 11 or 12 states and provinces that met up in the mid 2000s. Oh my goodness, do people still call it aughts, mid-aughts?
I feel like aughts is one of those things that people, you know,
that
pretend
never happened,
is a thing, but it doesn't happen.
Okay. I'm good with that. So a number of states and provinces met up and agreed to have some kind of a carbon pricing program. And so far, California and Quebec are the ones that have it in place and that are trading together. And the intention is for Ontario to join them.
Okay.
It's not clear when Ontario wants to join them, but people have been sort of watching how these auctions and these trades that happen with California and Quebec jointly, how they're going, so they can sort of predict what's happening in Ontario. And so there's some cause for alarm, essentially. Ah. So these auctions happen 4 times a year. I think this is the 8th one that just happened at the end of August. And usually they sell out, right? Usually there's about 95 to 100% of the allowances that are up for trade get sold.
Which is important, because if not all of them get sold, then the cabin trade is doing nothing. Because they're not actually because the allowances is how much you can actually emit, and so if you don't sell all of them, then people wouldn't have emitted any more than that anyways.
It's interesting because one of the things that could mean is that people have been, or emitters have been, so good at reducing their emissions that they don't need to buy allowances just because they're emitting
right.
so much less. That's
okay.
One possibility. Yeah. I'm not holding my breath that's a significant contributor to this. So what happened in May, 11% were sold.
Oh, wow.
And everyone kind of freaked out, and you know, this is really concerning because the price plummeted. There's a secondary market where the price is even lower than the floor price. So there's a floor price built into the system. So it didn't go all the way to zero, but it's really low, and on the secondary market, it's even lower than that. In August, just under 32% got sold.
Wow.
So we're doing better. We're doing 3 times better than, or we the WCI is doing 3 times better than in May.
Just for context here, does that mean that the jump from 11 to 35,
mm-hmm.
Was that percentage because they reduced the cap of how many there were of the total amount of emissions, or was it just because of the fact that we just are emitting more?
So it's interesting because the other thing that plays into this is the compliance period.
Okay.
So technically, emitters don't have to comply until the end of the compliance period, which I believe is 2017. So Quebec and California have 3 years to kind of buy their allowances, figure out how much they're going to emit, and it's a yearly cap, right? So you just add it up, and at the end of 3 years, the emitters have to present the governments with, okay, here's the allowances for all the carbon that we've emitted,
okay.
all the greenhouse gas emissions.
Right.
One of the things that's causing this drop, it's actually, so there's a huge surplus of allowances, that's the problem.
Right.
And the idea is that when Ontario joins, the price won't go up high enough
right.
because there will be all these allowances floating enough. It's going to be much cheaper to just buy allowances from California and Quebec, mostly California, just because they're so much bigger and there's so many more. One of the reasons that's happening is that there is a lawsuit in California that's been going on for a few years now, but they're expecting a decision sometime towards the end of this year. I believe December is one of the predictions. There's a lawsuit challenging the constitutionality of the cap and trade system in California. So there's uncertainty whether this will continue. I don't know what the chances are. I don't know enough about California law. But emitters are essentially saying, I'm not going to buy this. I'm going to wait another year. I'm going to buy it later, if at all, because this might not actually be a thing that I have to comply with. Which means that essentially some reports say that the price in Ontario, if Ontario were to join, the price will not actually get significantly higher until mid-30s. So 2036, let's say, or I think that was one of the years that was floating around. So for another, what year is it now? For another 20 years, we're going to have the prediction. One of the predictions is that the price per carbon is going to be around $16 to $17 Canadian per ton.
Wow.
Just for comparison, there's reports that say we need the price to be anywhere between 50 to 200 in the next few years in order to actually achieve significant reductions.
Yeah, I was going to say that I thought it was about I remember $100 a ton for carbon equivalents to be the sort of benchmark, but 50 to 200 is probably.
I think 200 is the highest I've ever read. I mean, I don't know about the methodology of these studies.
I'm sure they vary in the same all the ways.
Exactly. So one of the factors is the lawsuit. The other thing is that California could just be really good at reducing their emissions, and they're doing really well. So it's great because reductions are happening in California, so Ontario shouldn't worry. And if we join in, we're just supporting reductions in California.
Right.
So that's kind of what's happening. The other thing is if we were to link up with California, which we're planning on, I believe.
Yeah.
California has a law that says anyone they link up with has to have, there's four rules, and one of them is that the jurisdiction has to have requirements for greenhouse gas reductions and offsets that are equivalent or stricter than California.
Okay.
Up to this point, California's greenhouse gas reduction goals were weaker than Ontario's. I believe a couple of weeks ago or just a week ago, they added a new goal. So California now has a goal of reducing their emissions by 40% from 1990 baselines in 2030, which is currently higher than Ontario. Ontario's at 37.
Right. That's quite a goal.
And then for 2050, California's goal is 80%.
Wow. And so theoretically for Ontario to join, they would have to then match that commitment or have a strong commitment, or maybe, basically.
Yeah, I don't know. I just came across this a couple of days ago. That could potentially be an issue. I mean, this is probably – I don't know when these negotiations between Ontario and California and Quebec would be happening about linking up. That's just kind of a –
Another piece of the puzzle.
Yes.
Yeah. Because what's interesting about that, of course, is that far be it for I to poo-poo California on this issue, but you know, I like the idea of California saying that you have to have targets as strict as them. Given the fact that has anyone ever hit a target? Has that a thing? Like out of curiosity,
Ontario did.
Wait, really?
Ontario hit one of our
coal, right?
Exactly. Yeah, that's the thing. Our largest and really accessible low-hanging fruit has already been done by phasing out coal for electricity generation.
Right, yeah, which is why when you see Ontario's plan, it's so scattered because the biggest thing's done, and now they're like, well, what next? And it's like, well, there's natural gas in homes.
Right.
And that's like, which
and
is
transportation.
And it's transportation, yeah, exactly. But no, but you know, you apparently there's all these protesters blocking all of our cars. How can you reduce emissions on transportation?
If all those cars were only electric.
As an aside, I want to point out that the Western Climate Initiative's website is terrible. I just went to it and it is awful.
I don't actually know what it looks like. So I don't go to it. Often.
It looks so. It's just kind of like it's not GeoCities, but right. It's definitely like weak WordPress template bad.
It's one of the freemium.
Exactly. Yeah. Yeah.
Not to diss on WordPress.
No. Yes. WordPress is a fantastic tool, but it's like, I guess, you know, all government websites are bad, and so this is just continuing on that trajectory.
That's a rule, isn't it?
I think it is a rule.
To be a government website, you have to be really inaccessible. And universities.
Yes, exactly. Government and universities both have to have bad websites. So now that we've got that's an excellent update on where we're at in that. Is there any extra pieces of information that you think people need to know about these three things? Do you have any predictions on whether or not the next auction that will be happening in California will probably happen after this decision is made on the constitutionality?
I wonder. I'm not certain what the dates are. It would have to be before the end of the year.
Okay.
So
maybe we'll have one more before.
I'm not sure exactly how the timing lines up. I don't know if they know exactly when the decision of the court will be coming down.
Right. Which will be interesting because if that decision comes down and says you have to do it, then you could imagine a price spike.
Mm-hmm.
Opposite.
All these allowances are still floating around. There's an excess of allowances, and they didn't get bought, so they will be passed on to future auctions. So they're not lost.
Okay.
So it will take a long time for the excess to actually be bought up. That's one of the concerns, that the price won't really be rising significantly for a long time.
That's like, you got to wonder what the, you know, this seems like when something like this happens, it almost feels like the perfect opportunity for the government to actually make things more strict. Like, if you're not buying all the allowances, we're just going to remove some of them. And yet the plan is already in place, so they're probably just going to they're going to wash their hands and see what happens. Because if ever there was a time to do that, it's now. In the same way that I always think that, like, you know, whenever oil is cheap, that would be the time you should actually add in a tax or a stronger tax on carbon, because of the fact that it will still seem like a normal amount of money to be charging for oil.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and I think another really important part of this discussion, I'm assuming Barbara hopefully can help shed some light on this as well. But that, like, what we're talking about, of course, is our provincial. All right. And so the provinces have, power over certain areas, and the federal government has power over certain areas. And so there hits a point when it comes and the rules and, of course, the relationships between the regional and the federal government are different between the provinces and our government and the states and the U.S. government. Mm-hmm. And so where this starts getting really complicated, of course, is where, you know, if California has authority under the U.S. rules to do certain things, the provinces don't necessarily have the same sort of authority. And so it's entirely feasible that California might do something enact this new standard, which sort of acts as a standard under those rules, as you were just describing. And it might not actually be possible for the province to go, and it may have to go and get permission from the federal government. And once we get that, then, I mean, that now we could end up with a deal where it works, but it could take them 10 years just to do that. I mean, Trudeau could be out of office by the time they sort that nonsense out between the courts and all the different powers, and never mind the opposition at provincial and federal levels from the other parties. And I mean, this just starts looking like a huge, huge hairy mess.
Well, it's interesting, because I think California is actually a little bit worse off in this case, because what the lawsuit is about, again, I don't know exactly that much about California legislation, but essentially they have to have a two-thirds majority in order to pass a new tax. And so the challenge is that cap and trade is a new tax. This is something that Ontario doesn't have a problem with, and Ontario's cap and trade does cover, I believe, 85% of our provincial emissions. So I don't anticipate a similar kind of lawsuit happening in Ontario with regards to what kind of emissions we can cover. That's a whole another complicated conversation.
Well, sort of where I was going with that would be the idea is, you know, as you said, if we've covered a lot of the low-hanging fruit and we start going down the list about what else we can do, you know, for instance, if we're just brainstorming and sort of leaving the complexity of how to actually do it under our legal system out of it for a moment and just saying, well, what are the other things we could do? You know, enforce 100%, you know, the only thing allowed on the roads, for instance, like the Netherlands and several other countries have done, you know, you're just not allowed to own a gas-powered vehicle after this year, for instance, stuff like that. You know, sweeping changes and policy changes. Even if the province has the power to do something in that case, it may not be politically feasible. So they may decide not to because they're worried about being thrown out. And then, you know, which is a legitimate concern, because if they get thrown out and replaced by, say, the Conservatives, who want to do even less, then it isn't. Then that is a real risk that that isn't just up to their wants. It is actually okay. Well, if we try for this, we won't get it, and it might go backwards because somebody else gets put in power and they don't want to do anything. Or there might be other areas where they simply don't have the authority to do it, and they have to go through Trudeau. Which, even if Trudeau was to say yes, and I don't have any faith in him whatsoever, it would take a certain amount of time to have to bring another level of government into the discussion, delaying these actions even further. So I think simply because of the area of, as you said, the low-hanging fruit being gone, any additional changes become more and more complicated, potentially.
Definitely. Yeah, that's definitely the case. And I just kind of wanted to tie this back to what we're talking about with regards to the Dakota Access Pipeline. This is a bit of a personal confession. I think in the back of my mind, I've really thought, I mean, okay, carbon pricing is absolutely essential. We need carbon pricing. Everyone around the world, World Bank, right? Everyone agrees that this is an important tool in our toolbox for fighting climate change. And I still believe that.
Yes.
I think at the back of my mind, I really just thought it would happen faster and it would contribute in a more significant way. So when I would hear about things like, Dakota Access and Energy East, Kinder Morgan, Mi'kmaq people fighting in the East Coast, I thought, okay, we just need to hold these projects off for a certain amount of time. And essentially people are going to figure out that these kinds of huge fossil fuel projects are not going to be viable. And this is a bit of a, you know, privileged white girl settler realization that a lot of people I'm sure know already is that it really is being fought by the frontline communities.
Oh, yeah. 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 And it's, yeah, and it was, and like, it's one of those things where, yeah, you're waiting. It's like it's almost like if I can be an incredible nerd, which I feel like the show
has. Are you going to attempt to out-nerd me?
Oh, I might. I might. And because it's like we're all in the we're all in the Lord of the Rings. And
are you Frodo? Don't.
No, I am not Frodo. None of us are Frodo. Okay, Frodo okay. Frodo is off with the ring. None of us are Frodo. We're all humans in this story. And we're all in, actually, so what's funny about this, I'm going to say I was going to be a huge nerd, but I also forget the name of the castle that they siege in the second book. There's a massive, massive battle in the second book.
Oh, where the Rohirrim come in?
Yes.
And, Helm's Deep.
Helm's Deep.
Yeah.
Thank you. All right. Barbara wins the nerd out.
I knew this would come in handy one point.
And you know, there's the frontline communities who are holding off the goblins and the orcs for consistently over and over again. And they're keep waiting for this, waiting for the riders of Rohan to show up, which is this theoretical, you know, either sweeping realization of the world, or alternatively, carbon pricing to come in and actually, you know, and basically do what they can't do, which is finish off the actual fight rather than just delay and delay and delay. And I feel like that's where we're at right now. We've got these frontline communities are valiantly holding off, filling off Beale incredible lengths, and yet the riders of Rohan are nowhere to be seen.
In that story, though, they do sweep in with the light shining behind them, riding down that improbably steep hill, right?
So, well, I feel like we have to keep having hope, or why are we all here?
Well, so, we have to celebrate the successes.
Yeah.
It is pretty amazing that Ontario is about to have a carbon pricing program where we're pricing externalities. I think that was one of the goals of things that you want to mention every show, right?
Right, exactly.
And that's awesome, and we just need to keep fighting this at all fronts and realize the importance of all fronts, including the actual bodies of people stopping pipelines.
Well, exactly. If no one defended Helm's Deep at the beginning, the Riders of Rohan would have showed up to a completely overrun castle, and there would have been a very, very different story.
Right. Yeah. And so as we go to our music break, I think so the lessons learned here, of course, is that, a lot of it is sort of a delay until, you know, other forces take over, and I think your metaphor is very apt in that in that case. And you know, to remind people that, you know, the throne room was broken into before they showed up. So, I mean, it got pretty dark before the light came. Leaving the metaphor briefly, so we can come back to this if we desire afterwards. But the other important thing I just want to throw in there as far as the light perhaps appearing at the edge of the horizon, be it lightning or be it, you know, salvation, was that another story we won't really get into, but I'll just sort of reference to it, was one where the law in a lot of cases requires there are contracts that require under international trade, things like NAFTA, where, you know, there's conversations. We had this conversation on the show years before Stefan even was involved, and Stefan and I have talked about it before years ago as well, which was the idea that under a lot of these trade deals, like, Canada actually doesn't have power, essentially, because under these international trade laws, we've agreed to give a certain amount of oil, and it's not up to us. We can't just be like, oh, I'm sorry, we don't want to, because we can have the pantsuit office in international trade courts. By the way, TPP is going to make that a heck of a lot worse. So one of the cases that was interesting, this perhaps a glimmer of light at the horizon, was that, and I don't have it in front of me because I wasn't planning on getting into it, but just referencing from my reading this morning, was that there was an oil company that was requesting to the provincial government to make a certain, essentially, appeals on their behalf to not be under legal contract to forcibly dig up all bitumen in the tar sands, because it's under the idea is that eventually, as demand will increase no matter what, the idea is that, you know, eventually even the most hospitable and hard to reach oil would eventually become profitable, because demand will continue to rise while supply stays flat. And that's the argument. And that's why they're like, okay, well, we can commit to infinite mining, because eventually, no matter what, it will always make the case to dig it up eventually. And this was the first glimmer, was that the oil companies were even saying, like, yeah, we're not sure. We're not certain there will be an ever-increasing demand. So we're asking your permission to help us find a way to get out from this legal contract, to be forcibly dig it all up, because if we do, we're going to be digging it up at a loss, and this will sink our company. So, well, let us go to break on that perhaps glimmer of light on the horizon. Accidentally some dance music, because I was in a bit of a scramble to find some music today. We're actually going to go to Alex Veliz with Dancing Kazambona. Yeah, I totally screwed that up. It was my best shot. Here he goes. Some fun music for We'll Be Right Back. You're listening to The Green Majority on CIUT 89.5 FM, our wonderful community radio partners, rabble.ca, and of course, The Green Majority podcast with the extended podcast version at greenmajority.ca. We will be right back. Won't you play this song again? All right, we are back. You're listening to The Green Majority here at CIUT 89.5 FM, live on the radio at the moment, also listening to us possibly in podcast format, in which case you'll be looking forward to a fun as usual bonus show today. You could also be listening on one of our very appreciated and wonderful international community radio partners, or on the podcast version over posted over at rabble.ca, where there's lots of other good independent media being produced. But without further ado, Stefan wanted to take point on the introduction to the final section.
Yes, thank you so much, Darren. So a couple, of course, the very dearly missed Emma Ma has been hard at work with her, you know, actual job, which pays her. And so hasn't been on the show for a little bit, but very much sends both her love to all of you, the listeners, and also encourages everyone to check out Rock Against the TPP, which is an all-ages concert that is tonight. That is Friday. In case you're listening on the podcast, it was Friday, September 16th. Hopefully you went, if it's the podcast. If it's not the podcast, if you're listening to us live right now, you can still make it if you're in Toronto. It's tonight at 6 o'clock at the Opera House. Tickets are available online. And then if you heard this on a Friday at midnight and you're still in Toronto and you're like, oh, no, I missed that, but I still want to do something, there's a teach-in on Saturday at the Steelworkers Hall at 25 Cecil, so you also can check that out as well. So with those two pieces of information gone, I get to introduce Darren's next thing, mostly because I really wanted to tell everyone how much I – when Darren first said he literally just walked out through the door at the very beginning, said he was going to cover the Monsanto Bears. And in my head, there was genetically engineered bears, which only reminded me of Stephen Colbert when he had his own show that wasn't The Late Show. Always did the threat down. And there was a bunch of different threats. And the number one was always bears. So this is the Green Majority threat down. Darren, how are bears going to kill us?
It's actually Bayer. Bayer, a giant pharmaceutical company, has accepted Monsanto, the Legion of Doom, if I can call them by another name, the absolutely horrifying evil corporation. And I, you know, despite what people may occasional listeners to the show might think, I don't actually throw that around very often. I've accused oil companies of being corrupt and misguided. I only jokingly refer to them as evil. Monsanto's probably the closest thing to straight up literal when I'm call somebody evil that I ever mean. They're terrifyingly horrible company. We'll get into why in just a moment, but the news, why we're talking about it, is that Monsanto has accepted an offer to be bought out by Bayer, an even larger pharmaceutical corporation, for $66 billion, the largest all-cash deal ever as of this past Wednesday.
I love that all cash makes me think that they just have the world's largest briefcase and they're just showing up with $66 billion with this, you know, I don't know, with just this briefcase of infinite money.
The good news is we have some time because they're going to count it.
Oh, great.
Yeah.
Well, delay. The riders are coming. The riders are coming.
Unmarked $1 bills. It is in the U.S., so they have $1 bills.
There you go. Let's make them do it in Canada. It'll be more money, and it will be loonies. It will take so much longer.
No, we'll mix it up between loonies and toonies. It will take forever. Throw them all in a big piggy bank.
Sorry, Monsanto. You'll never get your money because you have to count it all first.
Yeah. So antitrust agencies around the world are currently reviewing it. There are no strong indication one way or the other whether or not it'll go ahead. I will simply predict and just say they will let it go ahead under protest, but largely they will. And this sees, just to put this into scale, these were already massive, massive international multinational corporations with profit margins and revenues exceeding many, many, many countries across the world. And already with a hideous, if I can use that word, level of influence on politics. Vandana Shiva is someone who's written an article, which we won't get into today, but she's essentially, you know, by fighting for farmers in India and for you know, traditional farming practices, and not, you know, by traditional farming practices, we mean not designing stuff that can't be killed by napalm and then napalming everything, chemically speaking, as the sort of status quo. And, oh, by the way, we've genetically engineered everything so that you can't reproduce or grow your own crops. You have to buy every product from us. Really just hideously evil stuff. You know, these are massive corporations. Bayer, of course, being a ungodly massive pharmaceutical companies, one of the biggest, with a just giant track record of just terrible things. They've done all sorts of terrible, you know, just bad deals and people getting sick and killed and bad you know, regulatory practices over their own drugs. So these companies are now going to merge. So just to put it into context, these were already massive corporations, which will now form probably the largest biotech and big pharma and big food companies all rolled into one, which will simply increase their power. And one of the things, just to put this into context about who it is that we're talking about, I'm just going to have to reference my notes here really quickly. So both have been involved to a certain degree in making explosives and lethally poisonous gases using shared technologies during both world wars. So these companies have been around a long time, including the development of the famous, or should I say infamous, cross-licensed Monsanto Bayer Agent Orange. Which, of course, there are still people in Vietnam being born with birth defects due to this as well. So essentially, like, a company that is powerful today because it sold weapons to both the Axis and the Allies, independently and cooperating, have now joined forces into one unified front of hideous evil.
Can you make that a Lord of the Rings reference?
Yes.
Oh, man.
Well, to be fair, that's what Sauron was trying to do, was he not? He was bringing together all these.
There's no I in Sauron.
Oh, there you go.
Maybe that was a little vague.
That was great.
Thank you. I told you I wouldn't be out nerded. So why does this matter? Well, I mean, it's indicative of an ongoing trend of the consolidation of multinational corporate power, the power and reach of which now exceeds in many cases all governments. Already you could make the case, but certainly with the passing of the TPP, which many fear is imminent, would in almost all ways that are meaningful, put them in a position of being more powerful than even the U.S. government itself, where it's not already subservient to it, especially when we have essentially legalized bribery in the United States. So the ability to you know, use Citizens United to funnel unlimited amounts of cash that, according to the court that ruled over that ruling that allowed this, does not even present the appearance of corruption, might I add, in that ruling. And it's just it made this even bigger. And the reason I wanted to reference the thing about the Agent Orange and their involvement in World War II is, you know, people will say, oh, well, you know, you're just against this, or you're naive, blah, 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 blah. It's just corporate progress and blah, 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 blah. Well, these are, and at the risk of going on my rant once again, amoral machines. Amoral, profit-driven machines, and they are now given hideous, hideous powers. We have a computer program. There's a great movie that's coming out. I'm a really big fan of sci-fi horror, if you will. So, like, sci-fi movies that are like have a sort of a suspense or a horror tinge to them.
You're really fighting hard for this nerd cred here.
Yeah,
like, I mentioned Helm Deep, so like, I'm going sci-fi horror. Let's do this.
So I'll throw down on that. So and it's a movie, and it's a very popular type of movie right now. We had Ex Machina came out a little while ago. So a lot of it's very trendy right now. I think we've moved on past zombies, and we're now on to rogue AIs as sort of like the go-to sort of thriller topic right now, which is great because I like it way more than zombies. But I mean, when we talk about the horrifying nature of a machine that doesn't have human feelings and thinking and will just sort of take its own desires and no thought for the care of others, that's what we have when we have a multinational corporation that has a legal responsibility to maximize profit to shareholders. And the individuals that work there may not be evil, but the end result is, because a lack of good and a lack of human compassion and a lack of an ability or a desire or a need or anything else to put human well-being above the corporate profits is by definition taking the human element out of it. It is often more profitable. Very easy example, slavery. If you have no labor costs, it's cheaper to manufacture your product. If you have no human morals and no human standards, slavery is a great idea. So that's why this is terrible. That's why we should be paying attention, even without going spending a whole show on the actual specific hideous things that both Bayer and Monsanto has done, that this is an indication of a general trend towards the supremacy of private corporate power, which has absolutely no moral responsibilities whatsoever by legal requirement. And this is something that we need to be paying attention to. And this is a great reason why you should show up to the two activities that Stefan just mentioned through our friend M.A. Ma, as well to stop the TPP, because this will continue to solidify these amoralistic, terrifying AI robots of profit from selling us out literally seed by seed.
Well, now that we've lifted everyone up, Darren, now that we've brought everyone to such a warm place in their hearts, everyone was laughing about Helm's Deep, and then we decided to switch it. We switched gears pretty strongly. You mentioned actually before the segment, you actually mentioned two stories.
Yeah, so I have one more. We've got about 6 minutes left, so I'll get through it here fairly quickly. So this is really an example of we prioritize science here over personal feelings. I often commentary on the science.
I don't feel that I agree.
But science and data and research is primary. But so I thought this would be an interesting thing to look at really quickly, which was that, science is not a paper. It's not I have a PhD, therefore I'm right. It's not an argument from authority. The process of science is not just to do research, but it's to validate it through peer review and through oversight and repeatability. The reason is because we know that humans are flawed, whether in some cases intentionally or simply by, not being smart enough or having made a mistake, very human problem, is so that you repeat it. And this is why you repeat it and repeat it and repeat it. Unfortunately, as John Oliver did a great episode on Last Week Tonight on scientific studies, and more importantly, how they're reported in the media, often science can be used to cloak what's actually true with half-truths. Which is not to be confused with, therefore, we can't trust science. It's that we need to understand what science is, and it's not a single study, or it's not even a group of studies. It's repeatability and testing and context and methodology, and it is boring, and it's long, and it's really, really freaking important. So here's why. The sugar industry 50 years ago apparently blamed scientists to point the blame at fat. The reason being was that there was a focus on heart disease, and the sugar industry, to some extent, knew that sugar was responsible, but they'd funded some Harvard research because there was also a component with fat. And so essentially, this is now just being dug up now, but in the 60s, essentially, the sugar industry recognized an opportunity here and funded a bunch of research that essentially started, and I think we're sort of out of it now, but I think all of us are of the age to remember sort of a big thing, focus on, well, fats and these sorts of fats and those types of fats and low-fat diets. And this has been a thing for about, 40 years. And this was largely actually as a result of science that was secretly funded by the sugar lobby to draw attention away. Don't make me make a Star Wars Darth Sidious reference here. I'll resist the urge.
This is not the sugar you're looking for.
Yeah. Well, I was also going to do this sort of like cloak and dagger misdirection thing. But anyway, but this is something that happens. And this is why we have to be very, very certain to know, like understanding those boring things, the methodology and the research and who paid for stuff and who paid for it doesn't disvalidate the science, but it can sometimes give you a tip off as to, should I be suspicious of this? And that's why, as much as we prioritize science and studies on this program, finding a simple study that agrees with your point of view is not good enough. And this is a really good example of why. And so we have about 2 minutes left, and I've been talking for about 17 minutes straight. I'm wondering if either of you would care to comment on that topic.
Well, it's funny. It's one of those things where you don't want to go out and be like science, like, because the science is scientific method is so poorly understood, I think, by the general public.
Yeah.
In that it's, people often say it's either science or this other thing. And as science says this, And then when he tried to explain to them, or whatever anyone says, gravity, you know, climate change is just a theory. But then he was like, but no, that's so is gravity. You're just still not going to jump off a building and presume you're going to you'll fall to the ground. That's how this works.
By the way,
theories are really, really difficult to become a thing.
There's a way to – I don't understand why people don't use this example more often. There's a really easy way to explain the difference. Music theory. It
right.
describes the method about which how something is done, not theory as in I have an idea or a hypothesis. When we're talking about the theory of gravity, we're talking about like the theory of music, not I have an idea about gravity. It's a different usage of the same term, and I don't know why anyone doesn't make that comparison. It's very easy to understand once you have an example.
For sure, but it's what I think what's interesting about this is that like then you get these kind of stories where you know science can be pointed at places by money. And to tie this to sort of the privatization that's going on with education and the amount of times that now universities are so poorly funded that they are now going out of their way to find other people to give them money. That's how you start pointing science is once you don't have a public people out looking out for the public good, paying people to study things. Because if you're not paying people to study things, you're not going to get anything done.
All right.
And then you end up with universities that don't want to divest because they depend so much on money that's coming from fossil fuels.
Well, exactly, yeah.
And hopefully, Barmer, you'll stick around and talk with us a little bit about the show. We're going to have a nerd out showdown and or maybe talk more about science on this week's bonus show. Other than that, have a good Green Week, folks. Thank you so much for listening to The Green Majority here on CIUT 89.5. Have a good week, and we'll see you all real soon.